good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology that is interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Matt Abbott, who is in for Lynn Ware Peak, who is, as we say, off on assignment. I think she's swimming in Montana. Matt is the Sustainability Director, Environmental Project Manager for our fair city, and we're pleased to have him with us this morning. Our first guest, Brian McInerney, is Utah's hydrologist for the National Weather Service. And we have a lot to talk to Brian about, including last winter's challenge snowpack, rising temperatures, and yes, a wet spring in the Emerald City. But rain is far less helpful than snow when it comes to filling reservoirs, and we look forward to our conversation with Brian.
And good morning. I'm Matt Abbott. Our second guest this morning is Kentaro Toyama, author of Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. The last 40 years have produced extraordinary technology and science. During the same period, technology has done little to turn the tide of rising poverty and inequality. Why is this? Our next guest will tell us why.
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay tuned.
This is Kelly Miller with Assemble Park City, a proud KPCW underwriter. Assemble offers a co-working space that provides a modern collaborative space for you to do your work on the web at assembleparkcity.com.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
American Roots on KPCW is proudly supported by Donna Van Buren of Greater Park City Properties, managing HOAs in Park City, Canyons, and Deer Valley for 30 years. Greater Park City Properties can be reached at hoa@greaterparkcityproperties.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Matt Abbott. Our first guest this morning, Brian McInerney, joins us in the Sweet Alley Studios. He is the hydrologist for the National Weather Service. 2015 has delivered another challenging winter for northern Utah. Fewer storms, warmer weather, meant much of the precipitation that has fallen has been rain, which is less helpful than snow when it comes to filling reservoirs. And then comes along the spring of 2015, which is hopefully more than a tease to an area that badly needs precipitation. Brian McInerney, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Yeah, thanks for the invite.
Great to have you back.
Yeah, thank you.
So this spring has been sort of a surprise.
Yeah, the spring was definitely a surprise, especially after the winter we just had where we broke heat records, we broke dry records. We didn't really have any significant storm activity that lasted more than like 3 or 4 days. And we went from October, which is the beginning of the water year, all the way through the end of April, looking incredibly abysmal. We had forecasts that called for some record low flows throughout the state. And then May hit, and we were incredibly wet, and we broke records for the month of May as far as precipitation goes.
Yeah, and these desalination plants in California, they're getting a lot of attention right now, especially with Carlsbad opening up soon. It's a billion-dollar plant. It's going to provide 7% of the water for San Diego. I heard or read last night that one of the people that is against these plants opening up, the reason that they were against them was because by the time the plants are built, the drought will be over. I mean, it's so short-sighted.
Yeah. We have to look at the long record to our area in the desert southwest, and then we have to throw in climate change and how you view climate change is the fact that you're going to have extremes like we're seeing right now. And one of those extremes is long, prolonged drought conditions that last for quite some time. And I think any method that we look at now to provide water for a population that's growing in a pretty good clip is a really good idea. And it really is short-sighted to say this, you know, the drought will be over. Because weather is cyclical, but you throw in climate change and it gets a lot more cyclical where we get a lot more extremes. We're going to have a lot more dry periods if you look at history. And when you look at how the Colorado River, the water is doled out, they made the compact when they had a very wet cycle. And so the water is over allocated really for what we have. So you have water rights. You have everybody saying, this is my water. But if you don't have water flowing through the system, you just don't have it. And they anticipate Lake Powell won't fill maybe ever again the way it's managed right now into Lake Mead. So it's something we have to look forward to in the future because our population is increasing. Our water future is uncertain. And how are we going to deal with this?
Yeah.
So we've been seeing aquifers in the news a lot. Could mm-hmm. you tell us a bit about first what they are and then what the implications are nationally and then regionally?
Yeah, so there's two ways to get water, and one is surface water, and we do that right now with spring snowmelt runoff and then into the reservoirs. And the other is groundwater, and groundwater is stored in aquifers that can be quite deep, and it's just over time. Think of a wet sponge underground where it's saturated in the intercostal spaces in the sand and the rocks and things, and you have this water that's been there for millions of years. And if you drill down, you can pump it out. And it works quite well if you don't overpump it out and you don't overuse it, because then what happens is it takes a long time for groundwater to recharge. The cycle is a lot longer. We look at spring snowmelt runoff. It fills up the reservoirs in a good year, and we're good to go. But groundwater takes quite a while. And we were seeing in the desert southwest a lot in Arizona that they're pumping too much and it's not being recharged. So now if you're a farmer, say, and you're in that area, you have to drill down even farther to really deep depths to get to that water. And if we keep this pace up, the groundwater will be depleted. And that's really unfortunate because it takes a long time for that to recharge and get back to where it was originally.
And with that, there's also been some talk about geological implications. Is there anything you can say about that?
As far as I go, I mostly stay on the surface. I'm not a groundwater hydrologist, but from the hydrologists that I've spoken to, that our groundwater guys are geologists, there's an actual settling of the Earth's crust when you pump out the water, and you have cities built on these areas that are dropping inches every year when they pump out the water. And the implications of that to me sound quite scary, but I don't know enough about it, but that's something to consider. Plus, you just lose that ability to pump water at a reasonable distance instead of drilling incredibly far down, and it's incredibly expensive.
I'm curious, every state has hydrologists. Do they, for the most part, agree with each other?
Yeah, for the most part. My colleagues in the National Weather Service all have a pretty good feel on what we do. And we forecast water for the United States. And when we do that, it's for water supply, and that originally comes from the river forecast centers. And then what we do is take that and then put it to life. Is a certain flow coming out of the river going to cause problems? And if it is it going to flood? Where is it going to flood and what time? Or are we going to be short so we need to talk to the water districts? We do this throughout the entire country, and every area is different than where we are. And that's the difference, because you have the hydrologists on the East Coast that have a totally different hydrologic regime where it's rain-driven for the most part. They have snow coming out of the mountains. The hydrologists in the Midwest, the hydrologists in Alaska, Hawaii maybe, and everybody's hydrology is different, and you need to learn your area. Like, for instance, I grew up in Chicago, so I went to college in Minnesota, I went to grad school in Montana, and moved to Utah, and I had to learn how desert hydrology works. And it's, you have the background for it, but you have to adapt that knowledge to where you're at and then apply it and then learn from the people that are already here. That's really how I did it, was learn from the city engineers, the public works people, and other scientists in the area.
We are currently in a drought here in Utah. Is it possible that parts of the state will be upgraded outside of the drought status due to the rain we've gotten this spring?
Yeah, I think there will be some improvements due to the rainfall we had. It was 300 to 400% rain in May. It's short-lived if we go into an extremely hot summer and we don't have the monsoonal flow that we had last year, and that's where the moisture comes up from the Pacific into Mexico, into Arizona, and then moves up into Utah. And if we have what we had last year, we had phenomenal rains in July, August, and September. Granted, that was part of some decaying hurricanes that were moving up the Pacific. But if we have that scenario, then we'll be better. But if we don't, then we'll see the gains we made in May dry up pretty quick.
Yeah.
It seems like you're tracking pretty dynamic data. Is that the case? Is it more dynamic than it used to be?
Yeah, it really is. Forecasting for these events, really for forecasting for weather, for flash floods, for water supply, is becoming one of extremes. And all we have to do is look at this past year. We had the hottest February on record at the airport at Salt Lake. We had the hottest March on record. We had some of the driest conditions we've ever seen. We had 48 days of consecutively above average temperature. We had the hottest December, first 19 days of December. And then when you look at the dry conditions, we slide into May. The people that are doing the water supply forecast are forecasting quite low amounts. And then we had 400% precipitation, record-breaking precipitation for May. So you're jumping from one extreme to another. And in the past, you always have cyclical weather, cyclical conditions, but you were in a certain range. And that range is getting bigger as we continue into climate change in a warmer climate. You have more energy in the atmosphere that produces more of these extreme events.
And so how do you, as a profession, manage those, you know, big ranges better? Are you guys getting better technology? Is the training shifting? Like, how do you, as a profession, adapt?
The technology is definitely getting better for the National Weather Service. We have much better computer systems, much better displays, more timely data that comes in. We have much more observational data that we can look at to give us a feeling of what's going to happen in the future. Also, we have to adapt pretty quick. We're seeing 200-year rain events in northern Utah on a pretty frequent basis that you haven't seen these before. And a 200-year event doesn't mean it happens once every 200 years and you don't see it again. It's statistically, they're so short and it doesn't happen very often that you only see these statistically every 200 years, or every day you have a 0.5% chance of these occurring. We're starting to see these types of events more and more. So now what we're doing is adapting to new software that looks into a radar image and gives us a three-dimensional picture of where the water is in the thunderstorm. Is it high up? Is it low down? Is it tropical moisture down by the ground? And if that's the case, then we can warn on these events in a better fashion because we can see where the moisture is. Where in the past, when I first started this job, the meteorologist and the hydrologist would just look at satellite images, which was incredibly difficult to forecast. So the technology is getting better. We're also getting better training on a changing environment. And you really need to be on your toes. And there's so many variables that go with this. It becomes more of an art than a science, a conversation when we're doing this. When we do the forecast, it's you look at it and then you'll talk to your colleagues. How does this look to you? What do you think? Well, in the past, it's done this. We've had dry soils right now that we're not taking into account. I don't think the model's handling this well. This is what the forecast should be. And then we run with it. And then the Bureau of Reclamation takes that forecast and manages the reservoirs based on that forecast, what they expect to come into the reservoir, and then use their operational benefits from there. So it's a moving target, but as a career, it's really interesting. And it's really stimulating to do this. It can become very stressful, though, if you miss these events, though. And they're becoming more extreme. They're becoming more rare. So it's something that, you know, keeps you up at night thinking about how your forecast was, or did you miss a warning that could have, you know, killed people?
We had the NASA and Goddard Space project manager on the show talking about this new satellite that was sent up and has been tested, and I think it's been in operation now for about a year. And what she was saying was that up until about a year ago, when we look at radar, it's basically East Coast all the way out to the West Coast, and we really didn't have the sort of granularity and the data out in the oceans that we had over land masses. And now that's changed with this new satellite that can effectively do a CAT scan of a hurricane or of a cloud coverage and actually look in a tremendous amount of detail. And the reason I bring that up, and I know this is a tough question, but what is the relationship between the Western area's weather and the Pacific Ocean?
Well, when you think of weather, it's coming from the west and it's moving east, and it does this continually for the most part. We have some weather systems that'll kind of come back from the east, but weather comes from the west. And so we're trying to forecast weather, and when you look at the United States, every day at 4 a.m. and 4 p.m., every weather service office launches a weather balloon with an instrument attached to the bottom, theoretically at the very same time. So now you've got a rendering of the atmosphere up to 100,000 feet, and you get a good feeling where the winds are, where the moisture is, and then that data gets fed into a supercomputer, and the models kick out every 6 hours a new forecast what the weather is, and that's how we do weather. But when you go over the Pacific Ocean, nobody's launching weather balloons, and that's where it's coming from. So it was a big disadvantage because we didn't know what's going on out in the oceans for the most part. You could look at satellite images, but you didn't get that good hard data. And NASA is doing wonderful things with science and atmospheric science all over the place. And this is just another step to get us to be able to have an observation, because you need to have a good observation where you are right now to forecast what's going to happen in the future. Because if you don't have that data, it's a moving target. You don't know where you are right now, so your forecast has much more error, many more variables that you can't account for. Any way we can observe where we are, that will help. And that satellite that NASA has put up is going to help us immensely. When we do snow forecasting for water supply, we have points that we measure snow on, and it's by the NRCS. And what we'd like is an aerial extent to measure the aerial extent of snow. If we could do that, then we could even do a better job doing water supply forecasts. And they're using satellite data for this type of thing. How deep is the snow? How aerially consistent? And then when you quantify the amount of water that's in that snowpack on the mountainside, then you can route it down into reservoirs with much more accuracy than a point in a north-facing tree-lined slope. And when you look at this year, the north-facing tree-lined slopes had some snow, but south-facing aspects were bare up to 9,000 feet. Aerial extent of snow was totally dried out. Soils were dried out. And we were overestimating the snow going into the models. So we have to take that into account. We kind of know that. But we have to do it in a kind of an art form as opposed to an actual quantification of the snowpack that's on the mountainside. If we could quantify the snow, find out how much water's up there, then we can route that through and the forecast will be much, much better.
Based on the current temperature of the Pacific in various locations and the currents and some of these other factors, can we make any assumptions about what this next snow season may look like?
Yeah, we can. And that's a good point to bring up right now, because the scientists, the climate scientists and the people that do long-range forecasting are looking at a very strong El Nino in the making. And that could portend for our snow next year. But you have to look back last year at this time. They were also calling for a strong El Nino.
They were.
And it didn't work out. It kind of fizzled until we had just a weak El Nino that really didn't have any correlation to the West snowpack, and we were dominated by that high pressure. But if you look at the data and look at the conversations, they're quietly confident that we're going to have a strong El Nino, meaning the ocean waters in the equatorial Pacific are much warmer than what they typically are. And they're warmer anyways because of a warming climate right now. If you look at the average 40 years ago for what they considered El Nino, a warming of the sea surface temperatures, we're doing that all the time now because the oceans are that much warmer. They had to raise the average or we'd always be in an El Nino. Well, now they're calling for a very strong El Nino. And when you look at some of the biggest years we've had, it's been 83, 97, some of the biggest events were during strong El Ninos, but you have to take this with a grain of salt at this point because long-range forecasts are highly variable and we just don't know. But when I see this, it's like a nice thing, like, okay, let's put that in our pocket and let's hold on to it and let's see how the forecast evolves. They're not really broadcasting it right now based on what happened last year, but it could portend to a good year.
Do we also need a cooperative jet stream?
Yeah. Right. Well, what happens when you get that strong El Nino, the jet stream comes directly across the Pacific, somewhere from the Philippines and Japan, and it's very strong and it pulls in a lot of moisture and a lot of dynamics. When you look at what's been dogging us for the past 4 years, we've had a big high pressure, a clockwise rotating weather feature that extended all the way down to the equator and went up to Alaska. So any storms that came across the Pacific would hit that high pressure, deflect north, and everything was shunted up to Alaska, and then it would go over the top of it and then down into the Midwest and the East Coast. And that's why they had such cold, stormy weather in the eastern half of the U.S. where the West was shut out. It was because of this high pressure. With a strong El Nino, that high pressure goes away, and you have this direct flow right off of the Pacific into the western U.S. And that's exactly what California needs, and that's exactly what the West needs for the most part.
Interesting.
And so when do you expect to have pretty firm data on all that? Or do we just wait all the way until the snow season?
Yeah, really, probably near the end of summer into fall, if these mm-hmm. conditions still look like this, then we can put money on it, maybe not a lot of money, but a little bit, to say that this is the event that's going to happen. Because last year they were calling for a strong El Nino. Mm-hmm. And then as the summer progressed into the fall months, I was hoping for it. It just fizzled and it got smaller. Then their forecast is for a moderate, then for a slight El Nino. And when you look at the correlation between a slight El Nino, there really isn't any good way to say with a weak El Nino, you're going to get a good amount of rain.
Right.
So that's where we are. Let's keep our fingers crossed. And there was also some research done by Utah State that indicated that we're going to have a change in the long-term pattern, and we're going into a wet pattern. So we're all looking at this and keeping our fingers crossed, but knowing that we can forecast weather for 7 days, but after that, the process falls apart in a pretty big way. And we're talking about what's going to happen in 6 months from now, and it's nothing you want to bet the farm on.
Of course.
And I always wonder this. We share a vocation in a lot of ways. We talk about climate change a ton.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's different things that can bring you down or bring you up. And what excites you most about your work? And like, what aspect keeps you going?
Well, you know, you and I have been doing talks together. It's pretty depressing.
Yeah.
It really is. I mean, like, think of this year. I went around and gave the forecast to the water districts, to the municipalities, and really put briefings out, and it was all about low water. And then you would throw in climate change and the high variability and the possible drought conditions we expect. It's depressing things. So for my job, I find to get the information out in an objective way that people can understand it, and then they can make decisions, like the water people, the districts. In 2011, we had a really big forecast in March for the runoff, record-setting volumes, and could be high peaks if the spring cooperated. So I went around and explained this forecast to all the water districts, and they changed their behavior. They move equipment out of the way. They stopped doing some construction projects, and we saved them a lot of money because the runoff was so gigantic that it would have destroyed all of these things. And that part is very nice to do. The part where you give depressing news, man, the room just drops when you tell them we're really short on water and climate change is happening and we're causing it and more to come in the future. And that's kind of a bummer. If we can get some way to stop burning fossil fuels and putting CO2 and these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and come up with a new energy source, I would think that would be fabulous. And maybe that's, I do a small part to try and educate people as to what our future looks like water-wise with what we have right now.
I just hope it's not too late by the time we act. Bill Clinton was on Jon Stewart last night, and he was quoting Winston Churchill when we first entered World War II. And Churchill said that the United States always does the right thing only after exhausting every possible option.
Yeah.
So, you know, hopefully hopefully we'll do something. And I wanted to mention, and, you know, we should make this guy Pope. Actually, he's already Pope. But Pope Francis came out yesterday and called for swift action on climate change. And he blamed environmental destruction on apathy, the reckless pursuit of profits, excessive faith in technology, and political short-sightedness. Gotta love that guy.
Yeah. I mean, he's got a master's in chemistry, and he's the Pope. And people listen to him. I think that's what we need is people with those high positions, political, religious leaders, our leaders really throughout the world, to step up and say, this is what's going to cost us in the long run. For short-sighted gains, we really need to get after this. And he did it, and it was wonderful. Now more could take his stand. And really, we just need to have a conversation about the science. This silly game we're playing where it's not happening, we're not causing it. The scientists answered this question 5 years ago. There's no more discussion in the scientific community that it's happening, we're causing it. They're now pursuing what's going to happen to our precip patterns. So for us to have to keep playing these silly games, we're reaching that tipping point at some point where we heard the professor from Utah State tell us that it was 2 degrees centigrade. Once we hit that, they feel the tipping point that it's going to be runaway climate change, and we're at 0.8 of a degree centigrade rise in temperature in the atmosphere. When we reach 2, then these feedback loops are going to continue, and we're just going to warm at an incredible rate. We have time right now, but we have to have this discussion.
I wanted to ask you one last question before we let you go.
Okay.
And unfortunately, we are running out of time. We could speak with you all morning, Brian. Always love having you on as a guest. And that's it. You could go to any major city in this country, and you could find out for the last 150 years on a given day if it rained and if it was sunshiny or if it was there was, you know, snow or whatever. But we really don't have a record going back before that. And we had a guest on the show named Lynn Ingram, who wrote a book called The West Without Water. And she was saying a number of things, but one of the things that she is a geologist, and she went back and looked at the geological record and said that actually the last 150 years in California has been fairly a very good amount of precipitation. And going back 20,000 years, there have been periods of drought that have been over a century. So it's really the big picture, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And we tend to look at things in a small period within our lives, or within yesterday, or a week ago, or it's the hottest I've ever felt it. But when you look at the long-term record on some of these drought conditions, it's truly frightening what could be. And then you throw in a changing climate and the scientific work that's been done that indicates that we could have these prolonged heat waves and dry conditions. It gives you pause. Where are we heading with this? And I don't know if we're ready to tackle any of these really long-term or really scary problems. I know when I talk to the water districts of the area and say, you know, when we're about 2035, which is only 20 years from now, our precipitation patterns will be roughly 50% rain, 50% snow in the wintertime. And about 2070, 2080, it'll be predominantly rain. By about 2100, we'll be a mostly rain-driven hydrology. How are we going to store water in reservoirs when it rains during the wintertime? Will the rain come like Seattle? And if that's the case, maybe we'll be okay. Or will it come in these deluges that we get once every month in a really hard rain and it runs off? Or will the vegetation change and uptake more water through the roots? There's so many unknowns with this. And when I talk about how we're going to deal with this, I don't really know anybody has a good answer for this right now, because it's incredibly expensive and there's unknowns.
Brian McInerney, who is the state hydrologist, always a pleasure having you on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Lovely show.
Yeah, and we hope you come back and visit us.
Sure, absolutely.
When we return, we're going to have a conversation with Kentaro Toyama, who's the author of Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Be a part of the Park City School District's future. 3 master planning public forums are scheduled. Grade realignment, new schools, traffic, and overall campus layouts will be discussed. Monday, June 29, 3:30 at the Park City School District office. Monday, July 6, 5:30 at Ecker Hill Middle School. And Tuesday, July 21, 6 p.m. at the Park City High School Lecture Hall. Masterplanning.pcschools.us or 615-0225. PCSD is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We were just speaking with Brian McInerney, hydrologist for the National Weather Service. Our next guest is Kentaro Toyama, author of Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. Will technology drive social change? During the last 40 years, unprecedented technological advancement, poverty, and the chasm between the haves and have-nots, haves and have-nots has increased. Our next guest is an award-winning computer scientist who designed technologies meant to address education, health, and global poverty. His conclusion, in an age of amazing technology, social progress depends on human changes that gadgets can't deliver. Kentaro Toyama, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. First, did we get your name right?
Absolutely.
Excellent. And we'd love to hear a bit about your path to your book.
Sure. So I am a computer scientist by training. I have a PhD in computer science from Yale University. And I used to do a lot of kind of very technical computer science work. But in 2004, I moved to India to help start a new research lab for Microsoft. And with that move, I changed direction, and I started looking for applications of digital tools specifically to alleviate poverty.
And was there like a moment where you shifted your mentality, or was this something that was kind of always in the back of your mind and you just kind of built your case for it?
Well, you know, I never really thought that technology by itself was going to address, you know, deep social challenges, but I did think that there were lots of things that technology could do and that possibly could speed things along. What I discovered over multiple projects where we tried to address problems in education, agriculture, healthcare, governance, and so on, was that technology ultimately is an amplifier of underlying human forces, which means that exactly in those places where, let's say, human institutions are either corrupt or dysfunctional, technology actually doesn't do any good.
Yeah. Kentaro, welcome to the show. I very much enjoyed your book, and you and I have something in common, and that is that we were both techno-utopians, I'll define that in a second, and we have been converted. My background is science and technology, and I used to believe that science and technology could pretty much solve anything, but increasingly over time, that's just not so. And this must have been a challenging book for you to write.
It was certainly a challenging conclusion to come to. You know, like you said, I grew up in an environment where I read, you know, biographies of, you know, Thomas Edison and Isaac Newton and Albert Einstein. And my dream was to grow up and, you know, solve problems in global energy through new technologies. You know, what I've come to realize is that oftentimes we as a society will have the right scientific answer or the right technology, but we don't have we don't have the heart, mind, and will to really use those tools in the right direction. So just to give you an example, you know, most of us know that a healthy diet and moderate amount of exercise are what we need for good health, and we have these incredible array of health technologies that help us live longer lives. But, you know, we don't do even the basic things that we know to do, and as a result, for example, in the United States, you know, obesity is at a historical high, and our, you know, longevity is not as high as in many other countries where people are, they live more healthful lives.
That's right. That's right. And the example that really hit it home for me in your book is that since the 50s, poverty has decreased steadily. And then in 1970, it basically stopped at a stubborn 12 to 13% at people being at or below the poverty level. And from 1970 for the next, you know, up until now, I mean, it's been unprecedented growth and technological advancement, and yet it has done nothing at all for the poverty level or the chasm between the haves and the have-nots. And that's pretty striking.
It is. You know, I mean, one of the dark conclusions of amplification, at least if you're a techno-utopian, is that technology, you know, certainly doesn't do anything to alleviate inequality, but it actually in some ways amplifies it. It makes it worse. It exacerbates inequality exactly because the haves, the people with educational, you know, political and social advantages, end up being able to capitalize on the technology even more than the people without those advantages. So even if, you know, everybody has the same technologies, which itself, of course, is difficult to achieve, even with that situation, technology only, in some sense, exacerbates inequality.
And I want to read a quote that you put in of your friend Bill Gates. "The first rule of any technology used in a business is that automation applied to an efficient operation will magnify the efficiency. The second is that automation applied to an inefficient operation will magnify the inefficiency." And this is sort of the gist of the book, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, at the heart of the book is something I call the law of amplification, and that quote from Bill Gates really captures it. What I think is interesting is that people like him understand this for business, but as a society, we don't yet understand that it applies just as much to, you know, education or governance. So, for example, you know, we have a tendency to believe that providing a laptop to every child is somehow going to help education, But exactly in those places where education is not working, where the school systems are struggling, that's just not going to do anything.
And Kentaro, I've been reading a fair amount of Peter Diamandis recently, and he's got a big focus on this abundance mentality. And I think there's a, you know, I don't think this is a polarized conversation where there's just, you know, Luddites and technologists. But the fine line is definitely, you know, I agree with your thesis essentially. And it's tough work, you know, working with people and helping them shift. You know, where do you focus your efforts? You know, where do you find the most leverage?
So I think a lot of it is that, you know, people like Peter Diamandis, you know, they basically are overgeneralizing from their own personal experience. So the people who tend to be incredible techno-utopians often have come from backgrounds of great education, a reasonable amount of wealth. They're often politically very connected. And so, of course, you know, they can write an email to somebody and that somebody might, you know, invest $1 million in their project, or they might give $100,000 to their favorite charity. And they see that email or that Facebook post as being incredibly powerful. And so they attribute that gain to the technology. But the reality is, you know, let's say, you know, a homeless person in Detroit, even if they go to the public library and use the same internet tools, they're not going to be able to have the same effect with the technology, exactly because they lack the education and the social ties. And so the difference is in, you know, what people bring to the table, not in the technology.
And that dovetails really nicely. I was looking through your background, and you're a fellow with the Dalai Lama Center of Ethics and Transformative Values. And the Dalai Lama is incredibly well-read and very up-to-date on technology. And his primary message is that of compassion and humanism. And I'm curious how, you know, the two sides of your work history come together, you know, as a professor and with this fellowship.
Right. So my, you know, my interest, of course, was to try to find ways in which technology could somehow enhance human compassion. And I do think that it can do so in a very localized way. So, for example, you know, if there's some kind of nonprofit organization engaged in humanitarian work and they're doing a good job, there's no reason why they shouldn't use technology to amplify their impact. Similarly, if you find a healthcare institution, let's say in Uganda, that's delivering good healthcare to its rural residents, then again, I imagine there's ways to use technology to help them do that job better. What doesn't happen is for us to spread the technology kind of indiscriminately and then assume that the gains that we see where there are good human institutions happen where there are bad institutions or where there are no institutions. And I think that's the real challenge, is that we turn to technology to scale solutions for us. But in fact, in these areas, you need a kind of a human substrate to be in place before the technology can have a positive impact.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Kentaro Toyama, who has written the fascinating book, Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. Kentaro, I remember reading when Nick Negroponte, is that how you pronounce his name?
Yeah, Nicholas Negroponte, that's right.
From MIT, came out with this program to build $100 laptops. They look like the little Fisher-Price toys. They had a crank on them to get the battery going. And these, at a million units at a time, were going to be put into areas where kids did not have technology and there was no broadband and that sort of stuff. And I was really excited by it. I thought, man, this is just what we need to do. But that thing was really a failure, wasn't it?
I believe it was. There have been rigorous studies that show that a laptop in the hands of a child really does absolutely nothing for their educational achievement. You know, one thing I'd like to point out is these days, every kid nowadays has access to a smartphone, usually their parents, but sometimes even their own. And if you look over their shoulder, what you see is that they are playing Angry Birds. They're not solving math problem sets or, you know, writing compositions. And I think that kind of shows you what the challenge is. It's not that children don't have a natural desire to learn, but they also have an incredible desire to distract themselves and to be entertained. And when you give them a powerful device that can do both, it amplifies both. And so they, you know, if the child is naturally inclined towards entertainment, then the technology also lets them do that. There was a randomized controlled trial in California run by two economists, Fairley and Robinson. And what they did was give some students a free laptop to use over the course of 1 or 2 years, and the other students did not get a laptop. And they tracked the performance of the students over time, and what they found was that in anything that you could call academic achievement, whether it was grades, test scores, attendance at school, disciplinary actions, there was absolutely no difference between the students. But the students who had the laptops, of course, used their laptops more often, and mostly what they were doing was either, again, video games or social media.
Yeah, and if you take technology and introduce it into a good school where the teachers are committed, where there are support people that can maintain and fix the technology when it's broken, you've got a better chance. But just throwing it into object poverty, it's just, I mean, you're just asking for trouble, right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, again, so if you believe in amplification, which I do, then good schools with good teachers and good budgets can definitely use technology to better ends and to enhance learning. But exactly where we kind of want to intervene and to provide, to improve the educational system, you know, where the students are struggling through their schools, those are the situations which don't make positive use of technology.
And, you know, we've seen some prominent converts, I guess you'd say, with, you know, Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation, their huge focus. I know Y Combinator has started to incubate nonprofits along with for-profits. Do you see more of a trend away from this utopian vision in the tech sector, or is it, you know, where do you see that going?
It's hard to say. You know, I think on the one hand, we have, you know, there are definitely more people interested in finding ways to use technology to address all kinds of social challenges. Some of them are, you know, coming in with a little bit more understanding of the fact that technology requires something else to have positive impact. But in a funny way, we see even more that there are other people who have gone the other way. You know, they believe even more in spreading technology. So, for example, you know, 2 years ago, Mark Zuckerberg launched Internet.org, which is based on the premise that if you spread the Internet worldwide, that it is somehow going to address the deep socioeconomic inequalities in the world.
Yeah, and that's you know, I always get hung up on that in my own profession. There's this, I work in sustainability, and a big project right now is energy efficiency. And the engineers come out, and what you really need is you need the sociologists and the psychologists and the marketing experts. And not just to sell a product, but to engage the population around the topic. And have you seen, you know, what's your number one example of a problem shifting away from just an engineering and tech solution to more the soft side?
So in my own work in India, we ran a project called Digital Green, where we use how-to digital videos of agricultural practices featuring local farmers as kind of a teaching aid to help other farmers learn better agriculture. And DG is now a nonprofit that's operating in India. It's funded by the Gates Foundation, as well as USAID and several other organizations. And what's interesting about Digital Green is that even though it uses technology, it's very, very conscious that the technology only works in partnership with an agricultural organization that has farmers' welfare at heart. So right now we have very large deployments in India, and we're ramping up one in Ethiopia. And what's interesting about those two countries are they are places where the government has invested significant amounts of resources and manpower to helping farmers do better. And as a result, Digital Green can piggyback on that. But exactly in those countries where agricultural systems are not being funded or are in disarray, it's very difficult with our technology to help farmers.
Kentaro, can you talk about historically about other technologies that when they came around, people thought they would take us to the promised land? I'm thinking of radio, film, TV. Can you tell us anything about that?
Absolutely. In fact, you can go all the way back to things like the typewriter. You know, I have an ad for a typewriter. I think it goes to the late 1800s, where basically the claim is that the use of a typewriter will help students learn. And that they'll become better writers as a result. And that idea seems kind of quaint. But it's, you know, it's similar to the ideas that, for example, that happened in the 1950s and 60s in the United States, where some people thought that television would replace our school system because now we could pipe in audio and video content right into the living rooms of children everywhere, and so they wouldn't ever have to go to school. You know, today we look back at that, and while we acknowledge that television can be used for educational purposes, the predominant sense is that television is entertainment. It's, you know, reality TV, it's the Kardashians. And we would laugh at the idea that the television is delivering education on its own. I think one of the mistakes that we make consistently is to believe that education is about the content, when it's really about the motivation of the child, of the student. And there's something about technology that kind of bypasses the motivation to learn with cheap thrills of, you know, whether it is flashy graphics or, you know, cool sound effects. And in some ways, the newer technology does that even better. And so video games are even more addictive than television was. And it allows the child to bypass, you know, having to work hard to learn something to get the kind of cognitive reward.
Yeah, boy. Tell me about some of these free classes. Stanford, Harvard, a number of other universities are now providing classes online that you can, not online. I don't believe they're degreed programs, but you have the opportunity to be able to learn about just about anything. How are those going?
If you take amplification as a theory and then apply to that situation, what you would predict is that people who have good educations, who have, you know, who are self-motivated to learn and who have the kind of economic slack to be able to take classes in their downtime would be exactly the ones who benefit from these classes, as opposed to, you know, let's say jobless high school dropouts. And what's interesting is that now that these programs have been running for several years, we now have statistics, and the statistics show exactly that phenomenon. That is to say that, you know, well-educated professionals are the ones who predominantly complete the classes, not not the people who are less educated who are struggling to find a job. And so what that shows you is that even if you make the educational content free and freely available, and in America, thanks to public libraries, you know, basically anybody can go into a library and conceivably take these courses. But the reality is that, in some sense, these tools only help the educational rich get richer, so to speak, because it's exactly the people who have a lot of good education already and who have good habits of learning who take advantage of them.
Kentaro, I've never met anybody who has been successful in business that has not had a good mentor somewhere along the line, and possibly two or three. And these are tremendous opportunities for people to help them move along and to inspire them and to show them, you know, give them practical advice. Is that part of the solution?
I think so. In fact, you know, I think it's great that you mentioned mentorship. I think mentorship is a great model for engaging in any kind of social change. You know, one of the really curious things about the business community is, you know, they understand the need for high human capacity and good intentions as well as anybody else. You know, you spoke about mentorship. I mean, mentorship is a concept that's very well developed in the business world. You know, in business, if you have a failing company, nobody imagines that basically upgrading all the computer systems, you know, getting a better data center and giving free iPads to employees is really going to turn the company around. And yet, that's exactly the model that the same business people often apply to education or to healthcare or to politics. And, you know, if only they realize that the same lessons that they learned in being a good entrepreneur also apply to being a good educational system or a good health system, I think we'd see radical changes in the way we approach these problems.
And Kentaro, personally, you know, I'm always curious how people live their values. How do you take these lessons home and enact them in your own life?
Well, that's a good question. Well, so, in, you know, there's some trivial ways and there's some, more profound ways. The trivial ways are, for example, that, you know, I personally don't trust myself not to be easily distracted with a smartphone. So I have a cheap phone that does just voice and text. It's actually the only mobile phone that I've owned in the United States, and I've had it for now over 11 years, I think. It still has great, you know, battery life, and it lasts for over a week without charging. And it's, you know, it does everything that I need a phone to do, and so I don't feel the need to get a smartphone. I'm worried that if I get one, I'll end up like all the people you see on the street, which is to say they're not paying attention to their surroundings, they're not really engaging with the people that are actually there, and are instead are constantly checking their Facebook pages. Otherwise, you know, my goal is to really still try to address social challenges, but to do it less in a way that is technologically oriented. And so I'm looking for ways in which I can use my background to help others, but it's not necessarily by causing them to be more consumers of technology. It's hopefully to help them become producers. So, for example, one way to do that is by teaching students who don't have technical skills but who have aspirations to be an engineer, you know, exactly the skills that I have.
Yeah, that's it reminds me of a saying in entrepreneurship, which is do things that don't scale, where you start out doing the things that, you know, if you think about how to scale things before you've failed a lot, you're going to scale something that may or may not work. Is there anything else you'd really like our listeners to take home from, you know, your book?
Ultimately, I would say that especially in a world like ours where we have abundant technology, and that technology is not fundamentally bad in itself, but it's entirely up to us as human beings to use the technology in a positive way. Especially in a world where we're immersed with technologies, it's even more important that we get our heart, mind, and will right. And those are all human issues.
I want to mention on page 214, you really boil things down, the core thesis that we should see, so, and I'm quoting from you, that we should see social situations less as problems to be solved and more as people and institutions to be nurtured. That says it all, doesn't it?
Yes, thank you. Thanks for noticing that. Took me a while to get to that sentence.
Did it? Yeah. Well, it took you a while to get to breaking away from the techno-utopian life, which you and I both shared.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, well, we want to thank you so much for joining us today. Kentaro Toyama, who's written Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. We very much, we both very much enjoyed the book, and we wish you best of luck.
Thank you so much. It was great to be on Cool Science Radio.
Okay, great. We will return with today's cool story right after this.
Looking for products and services in the Park City area? Look no further than the business directory on the Park City Chamber Bureau website. Visit parkcity.com. It features over 1,000 businesses, from accountants and electricians to painters, window cleaners, and much more. Our member businesses provide the Park City area with products and services our community needs. Again, all this information can be found at visitparkcity.com. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit, membership-based organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I want to quickly thank our sponsors, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, and Nexus IT. I also want to thank our two guests this morning, Kentaro Toyama, who we just spoke to, who's the author of Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology, and one of our favorite guests here on Cool Science Radio, Brian McInerney, who is Utah's hydrologist for the National Weather Service. You are listening to KPCW Park City, and I also would like to thank Matt Abbott, who has been our co-host. Matt, this has been fun. Good show.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Thanks for being patient with me.
Oh no, you've done very well, and we have a cool story, but we really don't have time to go into it, other than to tell you that LightSail is a privately financed project to demonstrate using sunlight for propulsion, and they are testing these engines right now in space. They're having some challenges with them, but they're looking at alternatives to traditional fuel-based systems. Please join us next week. Lynn Ware Peak will be back in town, and Cool Science Radio will be on again, of course, next Thursday at 9 a.m. NPR National Public Radio National News is next.